Hello and welcome to episode 24 of our weekly podcast, Long Shots. Before we move further ahead, a friendly reminder to all our listeners, do subscribe to our channel on iTunes, Deezer, Spotify, Google Podcasts so that you get the nice little notification every time our episode goes live. This is Nikhil Arora and I have with me Sharad Tupran. Hi Sharad, how's it going?
Very good. I look forward to Thursdays always because we get to chat about stuff that amuse us. And we're never short of content, are we?
No, not at all, especially this week. And you know, this week is strange because we typically focus on business, finance, markets. But to be fair, I feel a bit distracted. There's a lot of other things going on in the, international relationship side of things.
Across the border.
Across the border. And so, with all that going on, I think our hands are full. So I guess Tuesday morning, I know you are a regular Twitter user.
Yeah.
You must have received the update as soon as it was out.
Yeah. And obviously, I saw the update and the retaliation was expected.
Right.
I guess the shape and form of it, no one knew.
Right.
So, you know, I take it somewhat positively itself.
Right.
It's a response to something. It's not an initiation.
Right.
I'm all up for...
It's a preemptive non-military action, Sharad.
I like that phrase a lot.
Yeah, I like that as well. Obviously, there's always a risk of taking a political line while having such a conversation. But I think broadly, the gear change which everybody is talking about it is that how, you know, there is a broader geopolitical shift towards preemptive action.
Yeah.
Right. And I remember that I think historically there's always been a lot of apprehension against crossing the LOC and, you know, moving aircraft there preemptively. But that entire ball game has pretty much changed.
Yeah.
In the last couple of months, I would say.
Yeah, and circumstances have changed as well, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What happened on, what was it, 14th, what, 16th Feb or 14th Feb?
14th
Feb, I mean, that was, I think, one of the worst attacks on Indian armed forces, right?
Correct.
That obviously gets scrutinized from, scrutinized all the more.
Yeah.
For the right reasons.
I guess, but there's obviously a leadership push on that end.
Sure, yeah.
A funny thing is that on this Sunday, I was reading this very interesting paper article of sorts. It got published in MIT Press Journals. A friend of mine shared it with me. And it talks about India's shift from a no-first-use nuclear policy towards Pakistan to a counter-force approach.
Yeah.
I was very intrigued in understanding what a counter-force approach is.
Because, what is it?
Yeah, because as of now, the idea is that someone bombs India with a nuclear weapon first and only then India will retaliate. Whereas a counter-force measure means that India does take the right to hit military nuclear installations of the enemy preemptively using its own nuclear weapons. And the main idea behind that is that by preempting such an action, you destabilize the retaliatory power of the enemy.
Yeah.
Right? So, for instance, with China, India's policy historically has been a counter-value strategy where you actually hit civilian populations, right? But in case of Pakistan, it has always been a no-first-use policy, which is now kind of moving slowly towards a counter-force approach. You know, the article, I would actually like to add the link in our description.
Yeah, let's do that.
It's written by Christopher Clary and Vipin Narang, experts in their own domain. And the main reason why they kind of took such a stance was that they have been tracking military purchases of the Indian Army and Air Force, and a lot of weaponry in the last few years is more around, you know, precision bombing, strategic targeting,
surgical strikes
as they say. A lot of the actual weapon buying has been along those lines.
Yeah, high precision one.
Yeah, right. And that's why they kind of feel that there is a general shift in ideology. How effective it's going to be, because in counterforce strategy, the main key element is intelligence input in terms of making sure that you have intel on all the nuclear facilities of the enemy.
Yeah.
Because even if you miss one, that's good enough to get a hit back.
Yeah.
Right? And the article kind of ended on the obviously, you know, the usual that, you know, execution is a big challenge and only time will tell if that will happen or not. But yeah, it surely met. Geopolitics is one topic that I naturally find pretty interesting. I don't think we have that much time to go over it.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was an interesting read.
Yeah, no, we should definitely put it in the link. We should put the link underneath our video, our podcast channel here somewhere on there.
Yeah. We'll do that. Well, changing gears now from counterforce to the draft e-commerce policy.
Yeah.
have you seen the 42-page document?
Yeah, I did see it, and I did skim through it as well. I didn't see anything material jump out, which was groundbreaking.
Right.
They were more of a thinking out loud kind of document, from talking about the reasons of having data in-house to how, you know, there's a network effect which makes the bigger better and better position, which could disrupt the smaller guys. Those were just thought processes that were being shared.
Right.
What is an actionable step? I'm not very entirely clear, but you obviously did a lot more detailed research on it. So how many times have they used the word data?
Yeah, so this was interesting. When I did Control F and looked for that word, 248 times data has been mentioned in the entire 42-page document. And as you mentioned, most of it was in reference to describing the problem, you know, at hand.
Yeah.
Concerns around data privacy and cross-border flows. But, you know, if you kind of look into the specifics of this paper, I mean, it's a first draft.
Yeah.
And they looked at, I think, four broad areas.
Yeah.
One is looking at cross-border data flows.
Yeah.
So for cross-border data flows, a legal and technological framework, quote unquote, has been envisaged. You know, there's a lot of aspirational stuff which is in the doc, like it's saying that technically, if there is a e-commerce player who stores data of Indian users overseas, and if it wants to, you know, share that data with another business entity or a third party, it is not allowed to do that, even with customer consent. Now, you might think, how the hell will that be implemented? Yeah. Like, is there any enforcement mechanism in place cross-border? I don't think there is yet. Similarly, I mean, a big bone of contention that I think we saw when, you know, that entire data localization dialogue was going on along the payment side, right? Where the main idea was that a lot of times potential terrorists or anti-state agents, they use payment networks in order to source their funding. And when the government authorities seek that data from foreign governments, generally there's a lot of pushback. So now that already has been the case, and within this document it was mentioned that, you know, there should be a mechanism to ensure that when the government wants the data, the foreign government gives it. Fine, that's again an aspirational endpoint, but how do we go about it? That was lacking.
Yeah.
In addition to that, I think another big headline was the data storage requirement that I think the policy doc gives around 3 years to all e-commerce players to ensure that all the data that they collect on Indian users is now localized within the national borders. At least there was a specific time frame given, so that I think was good. Then third was, you know, they looked at a lot of, I would say, illegal practices which are going on, you know, anti-counterfeit activity, anti-piracy activity. A lot of Chinese e-commerce players have been using gifting, quote-unquote, as a route to bypass the Indian custom rules.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of specifics, details on that. And lastly was on the regulatory front. Good thing is that there's no new regulator for e-commerce.
Yeah.
Good thing is that
it's draft number one, right? I guess there was something that will come up subsequently. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the broad comment is that out of these four headlines, the most amount of detail would have been welcome on the data storage and legal and technological framework side of things.
Yeah.
But there it was completely lacking.
Yeah.
Most amount of specifics was around, you know, anti-piracy and counterfeit, which are more operational things about which you can actually clearly see that e-commerce is a very new domain for the regulator. So they're obviously struggling to, you know, put those provisions on paper.
Yeah.
So that was pretty...
Was there anything on, like, sort of, they've made an effort to demarcate, like, marketplace-based models versus inventory-based models, right? I don't remember seeing too much on that front.
I think it was just continuity. I mean, there was only continuity from the FDI norms around marketplace versus inventory-led models. I don't think there was anything new on that front.
Yeah. And when I read, I also found that interesting when they were sort of saying it's not just about privacy and protection and security. They were saying how localization of data is important for innovation and for local companies to thrive, because they think that data, and I remember we were talking about this line that they've used extensively, data is the new oil.
Yeah.
They were sort of
saying, data is a new coal mine as well.
Oh, they were saying like India is one of the largest consumer oriented society now.
Right.
We'll be pumping the maximum data which can be used by information aggregators or data aggregators to monetize. And they sort of are making a case that due to network effect, the guys who are already in it, there's no room for the other guy to come up, because network effect, the bigger becomes bigger. And once you're so big, then it becomes very difficult for the local guys to thrive.
True.
So they were sort of talking about it from an angle of allowing other players to come in, which is right now, let's call it, dominated by the Googles and Amazons of the world.
Right.
So, yeah, they were making that argument as well. I don't know. I don't have a view on how sustainable that is, because I do generally tend to move away from regulatory frameworks as such. But there might be some merit to it, that there is a network effect and India is extremely sought after. That I've seen in the last 5-7 years on how India is viewed as a consumer-centric society, right? Next only to China, I guess, in terms of lucrative opportunity to deploy.
Correct.
And monetize the consumer spending. So it'll be interesting. Let's see. But like you said, there's no action. Like, I don't even know.
When you mentioned that, yeah, there's a network effect and you have monopolies, right? Those monopolies are there.
Yeah.
Agreed. And all of them are going to comply with any localization requirement.
Yeah.
Right? And they have the financial firepower to do it.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's say 3 years down the line, Amazon, Flipkart, which I now consider to be an American player, right? To be frank, in this e-commerce doc, social media has been put in the same bracket as e-commerce.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So Facebook is also a potential.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm pretty sure Facebook, WhatsApp, Amazon, Flipkart ensure that in the next 3 years, all data is localized.
Yeah.
Then the question is, how does the network effect weaken?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they already are heavily funded. They have fair bit of cash with them. I think it's a very simplistic argument to say that, you know, if you localize the data, that will spike innovation.
Yeah.
I think, you know, there are other things which have to be at play.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Their argument is that, like, it impedes the emergence of other high value digital products, like, let's call it, even data storage solutions, right?
Right.
Right now, those data storage solution providers probably can't do anything in India if it's being stored elsewhere.
Yeah. On the cloud infrastructure
side. But there is always a case where someone will win, someone will lose, right? So you can't, I don't find that such a lucrative ideology, but yeah.
I mean, the problem is that even on the data support side, you know, on the data storage side, when you look at cloud infrastructure, I remember that in the document there was a mention of budgetary support.
Yeah.
So, I always get a bit nervous when, you know, the government decides that, you know, it will be at the center of developing a nascent sector, because, I mean, that's not the job of the government.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I really don't want a government body to say that we are going to be like, for instance, you know, when in the payment space, UPI was a tick mark for me.
Yeah.
Bheem app was not.
Yeah.
Right. UPI was the backbone infrastructure, which, you know, leads to other
payment providers,
providers to kind of, you know, put on an umbrella. But Bheem was a product.
Yeah.
Right. And as we discussed, I think in last to last podcast,
that
no wonder Bheem's numbers are going down, because now the private players are all at the same
level, and just significantly below the other guys, right?
Right.
They're not even close. Yeah.
Right. So let's look at the same analogy here, right? Like, you really don't want a state-owned e-commerce player.
Yeah.
You really don't want, I think maybe the regulatory framework is coming from the perspective of that cloud is an infrastructure requirement. So maybe that's why government needs to crack it. But it's not like a cloud infrastructure is not like a utility.
Yeah.
It's not the same as providing electricity, right? Cloud infrastructure requires a fairly sophisticated front-end user-facing interface.
Yeah.
Right? Whether the government is able to crack that, I'm not very sure. I mean, I'm pretty sure they will not be able to do the a job similar to like a AWS or a Microsoft Azure, right?
Yeah.
They won't be able to do that. So, I mean, I think they should stay away from getting into that game directly.
Yeah, no, I'd be very surprised if they get into that game directly. They'll probably incentivize local guys to do
it. The problem is that, you know, when you say budgetary support, it will always come with some sort of a conditionality. You know, they will never say that, okay, budgetary support is never going to be one dimensional.
Yeah, no, I would think something along the lines of subsidies though.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that's what they mean. I agree.
Yeah, that would probably make sense.
Yeah, I mean, tax credits, subsidies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So somewhat similar to what's happening in the electric vehicle side, right?
Correct.
They're sort of giving budgetary support, I guess.
Correct.
But without actually getting into it themselves.
Right.
Maybe that angle would play out, but who knows?
Yeah, that angle would play out. Yeah. I mean, that angle would actually be... I mean, sometimes I feel, you know, that tax credits is such a underutilized lever in India.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it can work beautifully if you want it. You know, it's a very soft, non-intrusive incentive.
Yeah, and it's real. It's monetary.
It's real.
The returns are real, yeah.
Exactly. And because it's obviously right now a very open-ended document.
Yeah.
Right. But I think there are already a few sectors which, frankly, due to excessive government interference, have been hit negatively. Like, for instance, pharma is one, right? I mean, in pharma, I think this entire discussion around price capping started, you know, starting with implants, then graduating to stents, that price capping kind of, you know, screwed up margins for manufacturers. And like, I know firsthand that when you look at cardiac stents, currently in the market, the latest one or two generations are not even available.
Yeah, we were talking about it last podcast, I think.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but now in this document, I read something along the lines that because of the network effect and monopolies, a good way to put that in check is to put a capping on advertising rates.
Yeah, no, I don't. That makes no sense
so
to me.
There was a there are those, you know, small strains in between, which kind of see some sort of regulatory overreach.
Yeah, yeah. No, I personally, generally speaking, I don't like regulations too much anyway.
Yeah,
I think market is smart enough to make their own. Like, demand and supply is a very efficient tool which can dictate prices.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I'm generally not very comfortable when government starts to step in too much. But yeah, let's see. This is rough, I guess, one, and they'll take the time and go through it and come up with something. I don't know. But yeah, on the face of it, doesn't really appeal to me.
Yeah, and in terms of actually like looking at philosophical, thumb rules.
Yeah,
you know, which I think work very well. Weekend was the time when Warren Buffett came up with his annual shareholder letter.
Yeah, I read it as well, and you read it as well, and it's always pretty good too. It's a good read always.
Yeah.
Park aside the content, but just the flair of writing is so simple and easy.
Yeah.
It's like a story.
Right.
And I used to read it when, you know, back in the day as well, like when I was working in capital markets, and you compare it with other shareholder letters and they're rubbish.
Yeah.
So many of them are just rubbish. They're just filled with jargon and are designed to confuse the reader.
Correct.
This is to the contrary.
Yeah.
It's made to...
And that's why it has such a wide appeal, right?
Yeah.
And...
So this one, what jumped out for you? I mean, other than the typical performance look back and things like that, but
there are some set pieces in this letter always, right?
Yeah.
Kind of Warren Buffett, he goes into a fair bit of detail on Berkshire's business model, right?
Yeah.
The insurance side, the float, how they use that as investment pool, etc., etc. So that always, obviously, you know, I think a rehash of the usual stuff.
Yeah.
And what I typically like in these letters is to, you know, see those off the cuff remarks that he makes on and off.
Yeah.
I think he, especially against the lack of logic in accounting rules. I mean, as per him.
Yeah, yeah. I remember this one line where, like, Charlie and I could find this rule very not at all sensible.
Yeah, yeah. He, you know, he typically tends to say things like these. So in this letter also, those areas kind of stood out. I think one of the things that he kind of was talking about a lot was how, adjusted EBITDA is such a ridiculous notion. Now, you obviously come from a equity research background. I've come from an investment banking background. What do you say to that? For the benefit of the listeners, what exactly is, what is adjusted EBITDA, right? Let's go to that.
First of all, I think if in our line, at least in my case, if I ever said that I'm not going to work on adjusted EBITDA metrics or it makes no sense, I probably will lose my job.
Right.
Because it is the go-to metric. It's what bankers, Wall Street loves.
Yeah.
It's what CEOs also love.
Yeah.
basically it's a number that you can very easily engineer to what you want it to be.
Right.
I'm not saying it from an illegal or unethical standpoint. It's just, there are just so much of flexibility in defining the word adjusted,
right,
that you can literally engineer it to what you want.
Yeah.
So, it's EBITDA. I mean, it's a go-to metric.
So it's an operating metric, but on top of that, you are kind of making it pro forma adjustments.
You're dressing it up, right?
To make sure that it's So, I mean, what kind of adjustments are there typically?
I've seen the craziest ones I've seen. I mean, there's obviously the non-recurring ones.
Yeah.
I mean, let's just back up a little bit. I mean, let's just define what sort of EBITDA is. It's a proxy for operating profit.
Right.
It stands for earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization.
Right.
So people try to back those numbers in to get a, you know, like-for-like comparison. People say that it's immune to capital structure differences, so people often use it to compare cross-sector.
Plus, it's a close proxy to cash.
Close proxy to cash flow, correct. And it's obviously an income statement metric after certain adjustments.
Yeah.
It takes out the effect of tax and things like that. So that's how it's done. But like we just talked about, like you said, like there's a word that comes before it these days called adjusted EBITDA, which is it's not the oldest creation. It's evolved over time.
Yeah.
And it tries to adjust for other things which they think are non-going concern or recurring.
Right.
So it could be one-off non-recurring expense that they have taken.
Right.
Or severance pay. And the most amusing one, and I think this was talked in this letter also, was stock-based comp.
Yeah.
Like, even that is adjusted. There is, right. I remember in some of the work I did, we used to have two EBITDA, because we never thought stock-based comp should be excluded. We used to have like adjusted EBITDA, but some of the investors would want it. So we used to write adjusted EBITDA X stock-based comp and including stock-based comp, because there's investors who want one or the other. Right. So we used to always calculate both. And you tell me, you must have seen a fair bit of, and for especially for media companies and even telecom companies, EBITDA is like EV EBITDA is the go-to metric.
Right.
It's not really price to earnings, which I think goes in a lot of other industries, but in media companies, it's a lot of it is EV to EBITDA, and especially if you're looking at smaller companies which are net income negative, all the more reason to look at EBITDA metrics.
Right.
I've seen various very funny adjustments.
Right.
What do you think?
EBITDA is something that I didn't really deal with a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, because I used to cover financials. So in financials, typically you look at price to earnings or price to book.
Yeah.
And but obviously, like there, the same magic used to happen with the
magic is the right word. Yes.
With net income. Or what do we call pre-tax profits?
Yeah.
So in pre-tax profits, often a lot of companies would look at two pre-tax profits, the reported ones and the management estimate or whatever. You know what I mean? So the main idea is obviously that the management has some sort of a strong view that this is more representative on a going concern at an operating level within their business, like for like, year by year. So they would remove or add things of that, things more than remove, right? So I think it's a subject. I think what Warren Buffett was using this as was trying to say that, okay, on an earnings bottom line basis, how good his businesses are.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think he was kind of, the main point that any business which does well on net income is a good business. No doubt about
right?
The question comes that if you're not doing well on a net income basis, how do you defend that? But I think Buffett was making the argument that we don't need to be defensive about that because our businesses are good on a net income basis.
Yeah.
And then on the side, he was just, firing a shot towards Wall Street.
Yeah, so, he did, yeah.
I mean, I really don't think that there is a, it's not black and white. Obviously.
And that subjectivity makes it interesting as well, right?
Like correct.
It opens up for debate. And
correct.
Restructuring is another one. It happens every year.
Correct.
It's not the same nature, but there is some kind of restructuring expense that most companies take, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of people treat it as non-recurring. Yeah. Well, it's been happening for the last 10 years.
Correct.
Why is it non-recurring?
And to be fair, I mean, P&L, if you look at like accounting, right? Accounting norms.
Yeah.
P&L itself is a kind of a framework-oriented picture of the company, right?
Yeah.
It's supposed to like depreciation is a non-cash item, right? You recognize that in the P&L. So, I mean, it's an accounting framework.
Yeah.
It's the same story with, if you look at consolidated accounts. Consolidated accounts is, again, an accounting framework.
Yeah.
It's just a way you use to steer your companies. Obviously, there's a fair bit of subjectivity in it.
Yeah.
And I think it depends a lot on which sector you're looking at. And there is always some sort of a historical reason why there is there. But I mean, it's always funny to read Warren Buffett's rants about these things.
Yeah.
I think another one that he caught on was unrealized capital gain.
Yeah.
Because I think they got a P&L hit because of that this year. So apparently, as per GAAP rules,
yeah,
there's been some change and now they have to recognize unrealized capital gains. And obviously, if there is an unrealized capital loss,
yeah,
that also comes in the picture.
Yeah.
And it was the latter in this case.
And this drives volatility, I guess.
Yeah, so he was like, yeah, this drives too much volatility. It's unrealized. So why the hell should we recognize it again? You know, so a conservative accountant might say that, okay, it's unrealized, but yeah, I mean, it's there on your books. So might as well, you know, show it. And
you should ask him his views on India's angel tax rules.
Oh, that would be
he would not find it.
He invested in Paytm, right?
Yeah, yeah, he did.
Yeah, yeah, but I think he's kind of gone beyond. He kind of entered at a fairly late stage.
Yeah. So I think Paytm sort of probably now evolved over and above that.
Yeah.
Angel.
And you know, even if there's an angel tax liability, it's going to be like small change for Berkshire. I don't even know whether that information will reach him.
Yeah. Some minion will take care of
that. Yeah, so he'll be like, yeah, yeah, some minion exactly will take care of that. And well, interesting thing, another interesting I think we'll add the link to this also in the description.
Sure.
I mean, I'm pretty sure a lot of the listeners might have already read about it.
Yeah.
But one interesting thing that Warren Buffett said was that he would love to make an elephant sized acquisition.
Yeah.
But 2019 is not really seems to be the year for it because most of the stuff is very pricey.
Expensive. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, I think, an interesting piece of insight. And I think that's what
maybe you should look at overseas markets where some have depressed valuations.
But yes,
but then he would say, I don't understand it. So
yeah, maybe buy an NBFC in India.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Depressed valuation.
Yeah, it's, that's really quite depressed.
I don't think a lot of them would meet his quality standard.
I don't think so. Yeah. 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 Because the exact said line that he used was the prices are sky high for businesses possessing decent long-term prospects. So I think NBFCs in long-term. India probably don't fulfill that criteria.
They don't fulfill decent. They don't fulfill long-term.
Yeah.
They don't fulfill prospects.
Yeah. But he does see value in Indian fintech, right?
Yeah. No, I mean, jokes aside, I'm sure. Or if you look for, there's a play. But again, it's he's always been most comfortable with Indian companies. U.S. companies.
Right.
But yeah, like you said, he's made investments elsewhere.
Right. Right.
Yeah. No, it will be interesting. But in that comment that you just shared, we're end February right now, right?
Right.
So when he says, like, I'm assuming he expects not to see a market downturn in 2019 then,
right,
implicitly, because right, otherwise I guess he would have said that we look for a nice time. So that makes me feel good, actually, that he's got a view on the economy that, you know, it's not going to see a significant slump or anything, at least in 2019. Might be right, might be wrong.
I mean, he says that it's, he is kind of commenting on the priciness of the market.
Yeah.
But yeah, he did not really point blank say that there's any sort of a bubble going on.
Yeah, yeah. No, and if there is a correction, he'd jump all over it.
Yeah, he won't be very. I mean, he has a very almost an ideological faith in the American economy.
Correct. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
He's always been like, no wonder he has, you know, he's invested in railroad companies.
Yeah.
You know, like, he's gone for such kind of assets because I think he truly believes that fundamentally U.S. is the place to be in. And I've heard him in various videos where he talks about it, that, you know, if you look at the legal frameworks, if you look at the safeguards, if you look at the systems, processes in place, this is where I'm really comfortable.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, the good thing is that, you know, he has on the face of it, I don't know whether he likes to show it or whether it's actually true. He has a fairly straightforward thesis.
Yeah.
You know, there's no song and dance about it. He always says the same thing, that, yeah, I basically look at high return on invested capital assets available at a low enough price.
Yeah.
You know, that's all.
Low leverage, yeah.
Go long, that's it.
Yeah.
Like, you know, he kind of stays in companies for decades.
Yeah. Have you read The Intelligent Investor?
No, I haven't. I think you have, right?
It's a good book. And in one of those...
So that's by his partner, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Charles Munger.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And in one of those pages, they have a handwritten note of the 10-point checklist that they look at for a company. And if it checks off all of them, then it's a no-brainer. They buy it.
Right.
And one of them is net, which means that the net cash flow. There's the net cash on the balance sheet. So they're like, if it's net cash, then all, you know, absolutely good. And they sort of look for liquidity, low leverage, and current ratio.
Right.
Leverage, and there are few things, and like you said, ROIC, return on invested capital, and return on equity, historical track record last 3 years. price to earnings multiple.
But that's the way it should be, right?
Yeah, they just got 10 sets and I think it can be fairly automated now.
Yeah.
I'm sure even they have some kind of automation in terms of just at least screening it.
Yeah.
And now it's funny, all Capital IQ and FactSet and art screeners, stock screeners, they all have that value investing screener. Yeah. And they look at those same 10 things yeah. that are there published yeah. in, I don't know what year, right. way back. But yeah, it's very simple. Yeah. But yeah.
And yeah, no wonder he doesn't invest in tech companies, right? Because they don't really follow that 10-point framework.
Yeah, it's just different profiles, right? And listen, and anyway, like from one accounting discussion, which we started off on accounting nuances, let's wrap it up with our next segment, which is on Reliance Jio.
Yeah.
There were some noises around their accounting. Not in a wrong way or anything, but just because it's not for a like-for-like comparison with the other telecom operators, just because they do things a little differently. So what is it that you were reading about?
So yeah, the background was, I think it's Bernstein.
Yeah.
I think they, the analysts at Bernstein have never been very bullish about Jio. I mean, they've been bullish about Jio's prospects, but, yeah. you know, they always kind of are putting out red flags. And they came out with a note recently, and in the note they were basically pointing towards two things. One was that Jio uses, you know, non-standard depreciation methodologies.
Yeah.
Right. So obviously, if it's non-standard, they did. I mean, what I understand is they must be saying that they need to depreciate their assets more.
Yeah.
Than how much they are doing it right now, and that's why their P&L is probably rosier than how it should look. And the second point on which I think I'd like to pick your brain. Is that they talk about this something called handset subsidies,
yeah,
which they say should be sitting in Reliance Jio, but they actually sit right now in Reliance Retail,
yeah,
and that itself has a significant impact on the overall P&L. They actually did a potential loss calculation for Jio, adjusting for these two things. And they came up with a number of like $2.5 billion
yeah.
of losses, which is far worse than Airtel or Vodafone.
Yeah,
they don't really take it against Jio, but they kind of rationalize Airtel and Vodafone's retaliatory strategy in that light. So, like, I think non-depreciating metrics we all pretty much know. What's this? What's how does these handset subsidies work? What do they exactly mean?
Yeah, so telecom operators that I've seen in the last, let's call it, ever since data has picked its pace. I think CFOs and telecom companies have tried to look for ways that where they can realize data revenues
right.
earlier. And to do that, one of the bottlenecks is smartphone adopting smartphones, right?
Right.
So one way they do it is sort of subsidize the upfront smartphone cost, make it more lucrative for the consumer, and realize that subsidy either through higher subscription revenue over the let's call it 2 years if it's contractually. So what happens is they take a hit on the... There's a discrepancy between the selling price of the asset of the handset from a retail store exclusively, let's say an Apple store, or from your own telecom store.
Right.
So that they try to monetize over a period of n number of months by trying to extract that value from data revenues, higher right. usage. So it's a cost that they take.
So it's almost like the data revenues act like an EMI on the phone.
Correct.
Right. I mean, they kind of...
Yeah,
are trying to monetize that asset over the long term.
Yeah, and in fact, like in the last 3 years, T-Mobile and Sprint in the US, even they started something, not last 5 years, I guess, EIPs, equipment installation plans, they used to call it. There was a fancy
right.
term for exactly what we're talking about.
Right.
Just equipment installation, I think it was equipment installation plan or something like that. But it was essentially just designed to do exactly that. So in Reliance Jio's case, they've been chasing subscriber growth.
Right.
They've been chasing numbers. And one way to get more numbers is to offer free entry cost, let's say, to get a device.
Practically free.
And then try to monetize on the data front.
Right.
And that, however, is a cost which should show up in your in P&L.
Right.
In Reliance Jio's case, it's showing up at a conglomerate level in, like you said, Reliance Retail.
Right.
So either you adjust for that if you want to do a like. There's nothing wrong with doing that because they are selling it through Reliance Retail.
But you can't really then compare. But Jio cannot be looked at that unidimensional lens.
Exactly. Right. You got to adjust for it. I'd be surprised if most equity research houses are not adjusting for that.
Right.
They can say that they're not doing it, but it's the job of an equity researcher to adjust for that and do that. It's not Reliance's job. It's for an investor or a sell side analyst.
I think it's also about sector knowledge and sector progression, right? I'm not very surprised that the only report or analyst which is making a lot of noise about this point is based overseas. Yeah. I think it kind of also boils down to that, right? And so what's really happening is that, say they have hypothetically, if they have a 2000 rupee phone,
yeah,
right, they are only monetizing, let's say, 100 rupees out of that.
Yeah.
So they need to take a 1900 rupee hit on their P&L.
Correct.
Which is being taken, but it is being taken on the P&L of the retail outlet through which it's being sold. Yeah. So, i.e. Reliance Retail.
Yes.
That's what's happening,
yeah.
Right?
And that's exactly what it is. And and it sits with their focus of getting subscriber numbers up.
Yeah.
And right now, all three guys are like within 30 plus minus 3 percentage points in terms of market share.
Yeah.
And they've really, in the last... 12 months, Reliance Jio has gained 14 percentage points in market share. And they snatched it mostly from Vodafone Idea.
Right.
But their focus has been market share, right? And to do that, they have to play this game of subsidizing it. But yeah, you got to adjust for that, right? The fact that you're taking a hit. And
I think it's a much bigger issue if it was a standalone listed company.
Oh, I think that would be borderline illegal then, I guess. There's an accounting fraud, I guess, if you're not realizing it.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's not.
Yeah, so it's okay, I guess. I mean, you keep on... hearing how Reliance Retail and Reliance Jio are looked at under the same umbrella by Reliance Group.
Yeah.
There were even talks of, them coming out with a new e-commerce platform. Now we are also hearing noises on Reliance Retail IPO.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
So maybe there's a structure there which will come in the future where Jio and retail are actually one bucket of businesses which get listed together.
Yeah. And that would make, I guess, intuitive sense as well.
Right.
And listen, Reliance Retail is taking about 2,000 crores per quarter cost in this equipment subsidies.
Right.
Now it's, do you push it to Jio? No, not really. But you got to adjust for it somewhere if you're looking at a standalone telecom operator. Because now focus for Jio will be to increase ARPUs. They will try to get that going.
This note also ended on that point only, that, the only way to adjust for these... losses are expectation of higher ARPUs in the future, right?
And, try to expand the top line and hopefully get and see some modest margin expansion, and there you go.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. And listen, conglomerates as such are very difficult to analyze because of these things.
Yeah.
And I've not seen, I don't know of any other company in the world, I don't know too many companies in the world, but I don't know of anyone which does retail and telecom. Reliance is one such company. So as it is, it's a little unique. It needs a unique set of, specialized set of skill set to understand those different movements.
The main funding vehicle is RIL, whose main revenue stream is from energy and petrochemicals.
Yeah.
From there, the funds are raised and a lot of it is invested in telecom and retail. Investors don't seem to mind.
Stocks doing well.
Yeah, so, that very basic requirement of corporate structure, right? Where's the money going?
Yeah.
I'm putting in, right?
Yeah.
But to be fair, I think it was only today in the morning I was listening to, there's this article in The Economist called Conglomeroach, where it was comparing conglomerates to cockroaches in terms of their adaptability and survival instincts and how, especially in developing markets like India, conglomerates have historically performed fairly well.
Yeah.
And I think investors are like, whatever structure you want, it's fine. As long as I get my dividend, as long as I get some capital gain, I don't really care.
Yeah. At the end of the day, that's what it is, right?
Yeah.
It's interesting. We'll see. Like Reliance Retail IPO, like you talked about, that will be interesting to see because it's a tactical shift as well as just a capital raise event.
Yeah.
I think it's more of a tactical shift and liquidity rather than a capital raise event.
Right.
So let's see how that goes. And we've had a fairly long chat today. And
time just flew, man.
Yeah, accounting heavy, but fun nonetheless.
Yeah, it was fun discussing all of this. So yeah, I think that with that, would like to remind our listeners that do feel free to obviously subscribe, share the podcast, post your comments, rate us, let us know your feedback, and we'll obviously try to improve this with every new edition. And with that, I would like to say thank you so much. And this is Nick Hill.
And this is Sharad.
Signing off.